B, C, and D on the outline because I want to get to symbols and go through the my notion of symbol in general. Anagogic experience and anagogic dreams, I'm just trying to indicate there, I want to say that there are times when that anagogic context that I would maintain is always our final context directly manifests itself in our experience. There are times when that anagogic context directly manifests itself or erupts, breaks into our experience. Two books that deal with this extensively and the phenomenology of the kind of times when I'm talking about are William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, which is still a classic work, these direct anagogic experiences. William James, Varieties of Religious Experience, and another classic of Rudolf Otto's, The Idea of the Holy, that deal with those moments where the anagogic context, the orientation to the divine, assumes direct manifestation in our experience. In other words, what I'm talking about there is mystical, what we usually call mystical experiences, where the orientation and to the divine and at times its satisfaction of that orientation, break directly into our experience. Andrew Greeley, and I'm not sure where this is, where you can find this, but he has documented, he's written about 92 books now. Never had an unpublished thought. But anyway, he has documented, and I think at least it sounds intelligent to me, I heard him lecture on this, how these experiences are more common than we might expect. They don't occur only in people who are given to hours of prayer each day, as we might expect. In fact, John Cross seems to indicate that they don't happen that often with people who are given to hours of prayer each day. At least there are long periods when there's a sense of nothing on the other end. But Greeley speaks about a survey that he did, and where there was something like 37% to 40% of the people who he surveyed could indicate in their own experience at least one instance where what I'm calling the anagogic breaks into experience and direct manifestation. Scripture, of course, as you know, is filled with instances of these experiences. Vogelin calls them, again, in his creation of words, theophanic experiences. Phanic being a word for appearance or manifestation. They are experiences of the manifestation of God. The conversion, the calls of Abraham, Moses, the prophets, Isaiah 6, Jeremiah 1, Ezekiel's call, Jesus at the baptism, the annunciation, the conversion of Paul, the healings of Jesus, the Pentecost experience, so on. Scripture is filled with instances where the anagogic is directly experienced. It is an experience of ultimate transcendence, experience that cannot be gone beyond. It can be enriched and deepened and so on and so forth, but we have reached the limit of going beyond. And sometimes this happens in dreams. And that's when you have the anagogic dreamers. Sometimes these experiences do occur in the dream state. I think Lonergan is getting at this. If I could just read, I'll read it quickly. I don't expect you to take it down on notes, but I'll give you the pages in Insight. 723 and 4 for the first quote, and 741 and 2 for the second quote. But his first quote is this. The solution to the problem of evil will be, he's talking about how God is at work in the world through human collaboration, working out a solution to the problem of evil. the solution to the problem of evil will be not only a renovation of will that matches intellectual detachment and aspiration, not only a new and higher collaboration of intellect through faith in God, but also, and here he's getting at the anagogic psychic experience, but also a mystery that is at once symbol of the uncomprehended and sign of what is grasped and psychic force that sweeps living human bodies linked in charity to the joyful, courageous, wholehearted, yet intelligently controlled performance of the tasks set by a world order in which the problem of evil is transcended. Talking about that psychic experience, psychic force that sweeps living human bodies linked in charity to the joyful, courageous, wholehearted, yet intelligently controlled performance of tasks set by a world order in which the problem of evil is transcended by grace. It's talking about the operation of grace now as it affects the psyche. And the second quote, 741 and 2, this transformation of sensitivity under the influence of grace penetrates to the physiological level, though the clear instances appear only in the intensity of mystical experience. We have stories, of course, of, you know, great saints coming out of mystical experience and how the radiance and so on is manifest on their faces. I don't laugh at those things. Moses coming down from the mountain having to hide his face because of the glory of God that was apparent on it. And I would add to what Lonergan says that perhaps that penetration of grace to the physiological level is what we're becoming aware of in the healing ministry of the church, as that is being exercised and today, the physical effects of healing, physical manifestations, reaching a grace even to the physiological level. At any rate, the dreams, anagogic dreams and anagogic experiences in general, they give you this kind of sense. Something like this. And I think this comes out of, for instance, the kinds of experiences that James is talking about in Varieties of Religious Experience. You get this sort of sense of yourself. In the midst of the vastness of being, created by and headed towards God, this is who I am. And perhaps what I am to do, find in the calls of the prophets, as God works out his solution to the mystery of evil. This is who I am in that participating in the work of grace in the world. That's the sense that is given to one in and through the anagogic experience. And then the D there, God is the measure of the soul. Like I mentioned before, the statement of Plato's, that the soul is the measure of society. In other words, that a society is as good as the integrity of the people who make it up. And Plato says God is the measure of the soul. The lasting Platonic insight. In other words, our soul is well ordered, or our interiority is well ordered, to the extent that it lives in orientation to the transcendent God for whom it is made. That is what establishes the order of the soul. The two statements of Plato now being reinterpreted through the filter and the screen of the kind of psychology that I'm talking about. The soul is the measure of society, and God is the measure of the soul. Integrity of the interiority is the measure of the integrity of the society. And what measures the integrity of the interiority? The orientation to the divine. Okay. Now, number E there, symbols and concepts. I want to get into this and spend more time on this because in this context, I think, we can see most clearly just what a symbol is. And that's what I want to discuss here. What is a symbol? What is an anagogic symbol? What is any symbol? But I think within the anagogic context, we can discuss symbol most clearly because that's where it has its greatest power. I've put together a notion of symbols by drawing on three authors and adding something of my own. So I'm going to eventually give you five characteristics of a living symbol, an elemental symbol. Five characteristics of a symbol. The first author that I've drawn on, and I take three elements from him, is Lonergan. In Method and Theology, Lonergan defines a symbol, and this would be the first element of a symbol in my construction here. He defines a symbol as an image of a real or imaginary object that evokes feeling or is evoked by feeling. An image of a real or imaginary object that evokes feeling or is evoked by feeling. So the reciprocal relationship of image and feeling would be the first characteristic of a symbol. Reciprocal relationship of image and feeling. We have a lot of images that don't really evoke feeling. But a symbol, one of the characteristics of it would be its relationship to feeling. Actually, that definition is taken from Suzanne Lane. Definition that Lonergan gives in Method and Theology. A symbol is an image of a real or imaginary object that evokes feeling or is evoked by a feeling.
What do you mean by emotional reaction?
Well, I think that might become clear as I move into the second one. It is more than simply emotional reaction. It's an opening upon a dimension of reality. I think we might be able to get at that more. If I haven't satisfactorily done it with B, then come back and push me. In Insight, he says that an image functions as a symbol when it expresses the known unknown. The known unknown. That is to say, when it expresses something other than itself. Something that we know of in the sense that we participate in the meaning, but that we don't know of in the sense that it's not encapsulated in the symbol. The dream of my friend shaving over the 68 stitches. Right. It's expressing something other than itself. It's not talking about his face. He doesn't have 68 stitches in his face. It's talking about something other than his face, but the face is the best expression for what it's talking about. The wounded face. Social confidence. It's the trauma in his orientation to the world, in the face that he sets to the world, his persona. So it expresses the known. Yeah, I know what that means. I know exactly what the dream means. I mean, not exactly, but unknown. The meaning is apparent, and yet the meaning is not the sign. It's pointed to by the image. So the sense then of the known unknown can't be circumscribed conceptually. The meaning cannot be circumscribed conceptually. That in the sense that one set of concepts will give me the meaning once and for all. It can be related to conceptually. Obviously, you couldn't talk about it otherwise. It can be, if I can use another word, using circum in the beginning, it can be circumambulated conceptually. It can go round, and in, conceptually talking about it, uncovering ever further depths of meaning to it. But it's not like, let X be the unknown number, and you work out the equation, and you find out that 48 is X, and that's it. That's what I mean by circumscribing something conceptually. Symbol is not dealt with that way. It's talked about in concepts. It is not captured once and for all in the concepts. There is a surplus of meaning that is not adequately fully grasped conceptually, a surplus of intelligibility. Okay? Now, in terms of your question, Leo, the feeling would be the kind of feeling that opens upon that surplus of intelligibility, and the feeling is not exhausted as you express the meaning of the symbol in conceptual terms. The feeling remains. It's not exhausted. And you can say, yes, the conceptual terms fit it, but there's more to it. And to get a conceptual articulation of it is important, and yet it doesn't do it full justice.
Nevertheless, this experience of feeling, talking about curiosity, wonder.
I would say that curiosity and wonder would be one instance of the
power of fear.
Yeah. Any one of those kind of primordial sets of
the origin stir of perhaps.
That's right. Yeah, particularly your anagogic symbols do precisely that. If they stir up a fear, it would be a holy fear. Moses' experience at the burning bush, if I look at this, I'm going to die. That kind of fear in the anagogic. Okay, does that help?
Yes, because I was thinking about this. Realize that that's the question.
This is more general, but yes, I would say that living symbols, whether they be artistic, religious, archetypal, whatever, I would want to come up with an overall notion symbol that would be applicable to the living symbol.
Just that the word feeling is
Yeah. And I would not want to leave it at precisely that point. I'd want to talk of it in terms of the intentional feelings, the feelings that intend the mystery. Reach out to meaning, to truth, to beauty, to good, to the transcendental, the order of the transcendental.
And those are only analogous.
Yeah. Emotions, when you're using that, that's another delicate term, too, because that can have a variety of meanings as well. Okay.
You're not saying that the grounds of the possibility of simple art.
Right.
Oh, no. For the symbol to have the effect that it has, or the symbol can have the effect that it has, because we are intelligent, rational, responsible. A cause of our orientation to intelligibility. See, this for instance, what is this surplus? It's a surplus of meaning. It's a surplus of meaning. Surplus of intelligibility. So, and then the third element from Lonergan on symbol is, again, in Method and Theology, he speaks of the symbol as establishing internal communication. Among body, psyche, and intentionality in the person. Symbol is a symbolic experience. The experience of a living symbol is a psychologically unifying experience. It enables the dimensions of the person to communicate with one another. The symbol is psychic, properly so-called, properly speaking, but it is rooted in the body. It's produced by neurophysiological elements coming into consciousness, neurophysiological patterns coming into consciousness. And yet the symbol has meaning. In fact, it has an overdetermination meaning, a surface meaning. That's its relationship to intentionality. So it enables those three dimensions of the person to communicate with one another. And in that, again, it differs at that point from a concept. I'm not against concept. I'm standing here for 2 hours every Monday. I were against concepts. But concepts and symbols are very different. And concepts do not automatically establish that internal communication that is established by the symbol. Conceptual language, if it's done by an artist, prosaic artist, an artist in prose, yes, it can establish that kind of internal communication because it's awakening this dimension of the self. The concept is not automatically that sort of thing. So the way in which the symbol functions then in our interiority is that it is a medium of internal communication among body, psyche, and intentionality. Now, those would be the three elements then of a living symbol as I find it talked about in Lonergan's work. There's no one place where he puts all three of those together, but it comes out of three different spots, two of them in Method and Theology and one in Insight where he talks about the symbol. Jung helps us to amplify this second meaning of the symbol as expressing the known unknown. In Psychological Types, Volume 6 of his collected works, Jung defines a symbol as the best description of a relatively unknown fact. A symbol is the best description of a relatively unknown fact. Relatively unknown, here's the way I interpret what he means there. A symbol is an inexhaustible reservoir of meaning. And will never be grasped with complete adequacy in concepts. It can't be captured and frozen. The meaning cannot be captured and frozen in concept. That's what I interpret him saying as meaning by relatively unknown. Again, it's the same to use the example of the dream of my friend. See, that's the best description, that symbol, the best description of what had happened. The face with the 68 stitches that he can now shave over. It says it all. It says that he's been deeply wounded. It says the wound is still there. It will never go away. The scar is still there, but it's healed. And he can face the world. And all that says, it says all those things. You couldn't say it any better. His response to it certainly was. He couldn't have said any better. But his response to it was not to write a treatise on it. You see, that would get it all into one conceptual thing. But his response is much more than awe before it. Before the over determination of its meaning, its surface meaning there. Yes.
Symbols that we're talking about, are we exclusively talking about dream symbols?
No.
No. Okay. Have we said anything about the source of these symbols then?
In the person or the...
I experienced the symbol. Have we spoken? I've lost it. The source of that symbol, whether it's in a dream or in a reverie, a date, or just an insight, symbolic insight. Have we said the source of the
No, we really haven't. The symbol arises in the psyche of the person. Okay, the psyche is the place of the symbol. Now, the source of it, what unleashes it, can be any number of things. The anagogic symbol is released by the communication of the person with God. The artistic symbol, someone who is an artist would be much better able to talk about this than myself. Heidegger has a number of things on poetry and the origin of a work of art. They speak of the way in which the artistic emerges out of Dasein, the there of being that is human consciousness, taking a particular contemplative stance towards reality. But in terms, at least, John, of where it arises in the person, which is in the second.